This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. Governor Bruce Rauner has criticized the number of taxing bodies in the state, but a McLean County League of Women Voters study shows they're at least working well.
We found indeed, yes, McLean County has a lot of governments, but it's not necessarily that inefficient.
The League's Sally Rudolph also says there are challenges ahead for small governments in the area. Charlie Schlenker has the interview. Hear about the challenges in hiring more minority teachers. You'll hear from District 87 Schools Superintendent Barry Riley. And ISU's homecoming is getting underway. Laura Kennedy gets you up to speed during an edition of GLT's Datebook. All of that, plus a GLT news update on the way. It's October 16th, 2017. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A McLean County League of Women Voters study indicates McLean County units of government work fairly well together, though there are some revenue challenges ahead. For instance, some rural township leaders are worried they'll have to go back to gravel roads. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with Alexis Kalish and Sally Rudolph of the League about their two-year study. The spark for it came from Governor Bruce Rauner's claim that there are too many governmental bodies in Illinois. Kalish says the League wanted to find out why and identify areas of governments are cooperating and doing things together.
The officials that we interviewed, especially at the township level, were very interested in being good stewards of the people's money. They are doing a lot to collaborate already, like in purchase of materials for road repair, sharing of the equipment. So there's a lot going on. I think they're good, practical people, and they get the job done.
What are a couple things that members of the public might not really realize are happening?
I think the road repair is probably one of the biggest. There is a group of staff people who meet regularly. This comes out of the Planning Commission. It's leaders from various parts of the government who get together and discuss issues that are arising in a very informal way so they can do problem solving. We sat in on one of their meetings. That day they weren't handling anything particularly difficult, but they were talking about the signage for bicycles. And it just showed, even though that's not a hugely important task, how important it is for them to cooperate and be similar in their approach.
Any thoughts, Sally?
I wanted to mention the impetus for this study really was this conversation that's been going on for a long time statewide, you know, too many governments in Illinois. And the Governor Rauner got on that and appointed the Lieutenant Governor's task force on that very issue. And so it occurred to us that we the League, should attempt to find out, in a way, why there are so many governments and if there are any possibilities for less governments. And I think one of our big conclusions in that regard is there's no one-size-fits-all for the state of Illinois. You know, someone at the state level can say there are too many governments, but what does that really mean to DuPage County versus McLean County? And there's huge differences all over the place. So we found, indeed, yes, McLean County has a lot of governments, but it's not necessarily that inefficient.
Are there cases where there are duplicative functions that are clearly subject to an idea that these could be combined, that these taxing bodies could be merged in some fashion?
We didn't really find any. You have to understand that this is a limited study done by 30 volunteers. It's other studies that we looked at that have been done statewide had staff and lots more resources than we did. So we can't really point to any real overlap duplication that we found. But that doesn't say they don't exist.
One of the interesting things was there are so many groups that deal with water, and you would think that in that there would be duplication, but we really did not find overlap.
And do they coordinate and talk with each other and communicate in the same way that you were giving the example earlier in an informal fashion among the bicycle signage effort?
There are two groups in the county that we think have a lot of potential for doing more. One is the Mayor's Association, which does include a Bloomington Normal from time to time. We think there's a lot of potential for that organization to discuss. The mayors themselves know the needs better than we for them to discuss it. And then there's also an association of township officials that meet. I think both these groups meet quarterly. And the Township Officials Organization, we attended meetings of both of these groups, and we feel that they could possibly do more to talk to each other and figure out what needs to be done. But we're not telling them what needs to be done because, frankly, we don't know.
How would that look? What would they need to do to make their time together more productive?
The Mayor's Association is one of the meetings that we sat in on. That particular meeting, there were a number of mayors in attendance, but there were also a number who do not attend, or village presidents, whichever. That is one thing. They need to get everybody on board, make everybody feel that this is important to them, of value to them.
It strikes me, though, that you're going to get different elected officials who have lives and who are different human beings and have different ideas of their service. And so participation in that sort of joint coordinative effort is going to wax and wane with the people who hold the offices. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to encourage buy-in in a multi-generational elected official fashion?
I think it would be up to them to figure it out, but I think they could.
They have a person in charge now who's relatively dynamic, and hopefully he will be able to bring folks on board. Part of the problem is in the rural communities, there is a challenge to find leadership. So you do see a great variation in how engaged different mayors are.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Alexis Kalish and Sally Rudolph of the League of Women Voters of McLean County. They are respectively a board secretary and team leader and a study leader on this new study of local governments in McLean County. How much needs to be formal and how much needs to be informal?
If we could refer maybe to the Springfield or Sangamon County Citizens Initiative, I think it's CEC they call it, Citizens Efficiency Commission, which was actually formed by referendum down there in 2010. It's interesting because this is 2017. They have the same amount of governments as they had when they started. However, they feel that a lot of progress has been made just by their very existence because two groups have formed, like with the ones we were just talking about, the Mayor's Association and the Township Officials, that formed as a result of their study. And they feel that they have come a long way as far as these governments working together. And they think it's probably a better way to go than actually combining.
And Alexis, you talked about the informality of one of the meetings that you attended, and it wasn't a top-level meeting. Where is the most constructive engagement for a lot of these issues in common to people in McLean County? Is it at the Planning Commission level or the city, village, township subcommittee level, board? Where is the best place for engagement?
All of the above. I think that's what a lot of these studies are finding, that when people with like responsibilities get together and discuss their resources and their responsibilities, that they come up with maybe new and unique ideas to solve their problems.
The study also looked at challenges ahead. Sally?
Well, a big one, maybe the biggest, was limited citizen involvement. Officials, many of them told us that this was the case, that it's very hard to get other citizens engaged in the process of what they're doing for their local governments. And that goes along with the citizens' limited knowledge of governmental services. Another one that was mentioned pretty frequently was limited media coverage of government efforts. Over the decades, we've all noticed, and certainly these governmental officials have noticed, that there's less media coverage. Difficulty finding candidates to run for office in the governments, small governments in particular, even appointments, finding people to accept appointments. And the county board makes a lot of appointments to a lot of the governments in the county, special districts, and it's difficult to. And then the big one in the rural areas, declining funds and declining populations.
One of the reasons we did this study was because there's a lot of talk about the collar communities doing consolidations, and what works for them does not necessarily work for McLean County. We're the largest county geographically. We have like 1,800 miles of road to maintain. With a consolidation of farms, we see the population migrating from the rural communities to the towns and cities. So the tax base is lowering. The motor fuel tax is lowering because of the more fuel-efficient cars. So McLean County has a lot of rural community, and that is particularly challenging and increasingly so.
What is a way to encourage citizen involvement? That's partly a generational thing, partly an artifact of the need for both partners in an adult household to work. There's less time for volunteerism, less time for public service, and so where's the cure for that? Even assuming that you have bodies in an urban area, and we haven't touched on the rural part yet. We'll get back to that.
That's a challenge that is affecting probably every organization that we have, including the League. We do a concerted effort to bring in some of the younger people, the Art Center, the Symphony, bringing in younger folks and supporters. Part of it is keeping up with technology. Part of it is embracing the way that younger people work together. It's difficult for me sometimes because I'm now in the older generation, and I have to think about how other people want to have their life, have their participation go.
Ideally, every local government, all 200 of them in the county, would have some kind of a leadership development plan, how it's going to evolve, instead of, you know, the shotgun approach. And we would certainly encourage that. As Alexa says, it's also true of organizations, but very true of these local governments. What's the succession plan here?
Human beings, though, operate often in crisis mode. Certainly, mm-hmm. We've seen that in Springfield and Washington, and I suspect that is true in local grassroots governmental bodies as well. That, who are we going to get to fill this job? Let's look around and get the first available body. It's not easy to look out past that short-term horizon to get that development plan really functional and routine as part of the life of the organization. How do you transfer that from one generation to the next of leaders?
It's so individual. It has to be up to the individual township, the individual water district, the individual fire district. It's very hard to make a general statement, I think. Mm-hmm.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking about the League of Women Voters Study on Governments. With us are Alexis Kalish and Sally Rudolph. Turning now to the rural area, is McLean County, in your view and in the report writer's view, in danger of having loss of service because of the hollowing of the countryside?
We definitely heard that in regard to road maintenance. It's a big worry out there among the road commissioners and township supervisors that there just won't be the money to maintain the roads if things continue on the path they're on. So that was, I think we heard that worry the most.
And that they might have to reduce the level of treatment that they provide the roads. Rather than having the tar and chip, they might have gravel roads.
How far away are we from that sort of choice?
Maybe not as far as we think. It sounds like something way in the future, but we were hearing some pretty alarming things.
Another area was the tiling in the farmlands was done, in the 1930s, a lot of it, and it's beginning to deteriorate, need to be replaced. So that's another big challenge that's facing the rural areas.
That's up to the landowner, though, isn't it? Or should there be a public role in that?
There's cooperation. There are districts that come together and help determine where that tiling lays.
We should perhaps also identify for people in the urban area that tiling is a subsurface drainage conduit that helps move water around underground the farm field and prevents sodden fields while still allowing for the necessary amount of water. And over time, over a period of decades, those tiles silt in and need to be replaced. Nowadays, they do it with plastic. In the 30s, they did it with terracotta pipes.
We're talking about tiling where there is a governmental unit that's been created. Usually, they were created in the 1920s. Not all the farmland in McLean County is in a district. So if they're in a district, the district does have the ability to assess and improve their district, and I'm sure it gets a little controversial out there at times.
But the public good that results from tiling projects is to maintain arable land or maintain usable land, whether it's public land or private land. Mm-hmm. How big is this issue in McLean County?
We interviewed a couple of water district people, and I think it varies a great deal depending on what's happening in an area. We heard that, one area might need to have this huge expense going on where others can go on for years without too much expense. So it's with this huge county we're in, it varies greatly.
Is there still buy-in to the idea of that as a public good, or is that an education process that's going to have to be renewed all these decades later?
The one official that comes to my mind has been doing it. He's a product, I think, maybe third generation that's been doing this job, and I think his predecessors have built up a huge amount of trust among the people in their district that they will make the right decisions and not waste money.
Sally Rudolph and Alexis Kalish of the McLean County League of Women Voters speaking with GLT's Charlie Schlenker. They say one lesson they've learned is that if there's to be a taxing body consolidation, it has to be driven by the people involved. And Rudolph says Sangamon County's experience yielded the insight that it's far easier to have intergovernmental agreements on cooperative ventures than actual consolidation. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, GLT, and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT's Sound Ideas comes from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd, helping investors plan for the future and stay on track for retirement and college savings based on their unique situations and goals. Details at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
Ahead during Sound Ideas, hear about the challenges in boosting minority teachers in Bloomington Normal. It's a conversation with District 87 Schools Superintendent Barry Riley. That's still to come during Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. A new effort to get kids more active and in touch with their thoughts has come to Springfield's public school district in the form of yoga classes. As Rachel Otwell reports, it could also have implications for how students are disciplined in the future.
Welcome. This is our very first meeting. Does anybody know what my name is?
No.
Within the last year, Ashley Kristolovich quit her desk job. She's embarked on a personal and now professional journey that's all about mindfulness and movement. She's a certified yoga instructor, also trained in what's called mindfulness-based stress reduction. Today, she's teaching her first yoga class at Washington Middle School on the north end of the city. There are about 20 kids spread out in the library, sitting on colorful yoga mats. Kristolovich is leading them through a deep breathing exercise.
And you know what? Constantly sucking in and holding your breath, you know what that makes you? Nervous, anxious, upset, scared, like an invisible tiger is chasing you.
Kristolovich teaches the kids how to breathe with their diaphragm. Some look surprised to see their bellies getting big as they inhale. There's movement too, of course, and they quickly cycle through a yoga routine.
Because what we're going to be doing now is, you know what you do in yoga? You connect things like breath and movement.
Kids will continue to have the chance to meet after school on Wednesdays. Kristolovich has volunteered to hold class for the students weekly. It's not a new concept. In Chicago, Annie Warshaw is CEO and founder of Mission Propel, an organization that works with schools to teach girls lessons that incorporate yoga. That's from a promotional video. Warshaw explains.
Girls yell out different mantras according to that pose. So for example, when they're in Warrior One, they bring up their arms, they kiss their muscles every single time, and then they scream, "I am strong."
For Warshaw, the aim is all about female empowerment that starts at a young age. Back in Springfield at Washington Middle School, Gail Neely is the social-emotional coach. It's a new position that works with kids who need extra help in those areas. She's a big fan of yoga herself and hopes it will make a difference with the students.
A little bit of self-regulation, where I know I'm getting angry, but I don't have to act out on it. I can be angry and still be okay.
Principal Vincent Turner comes at the end of class and suggests yoga could potentially be used as part of the discipline process, more along the trend of restorative justice, where students are taught about conflict resolution instead of being put in detention or suspended.
It would definitely be a consideration. We're moving forward with a lot of different approaches to restorative practices, and if this would be something that we could see have a benefit for students, we definitely want to try.
Desiree is 12 years old. She, like the rest of the kids, stayed engaged throughout the afternoon's activities.
Well, my mom said that like yoga helps like with kids that like have anger issues and stuff like that. Sometimes I get mad and stuff, so I came to like help with my anger issues.
She says she's already learned one coping mechanism.
If I get mad, like I can take like a deep breath and like it can help me.
Instructor Ashley Kristolovich says this is what her new path is all about, and she has a special place in her heart for working with kids, especially at a place like this where nearly two-thirds of them come from low-income households.
I want to be the person that I needed when I was growing up, so that's why I'm doing it. This is my way to come back and give them things that I wish I would have had that helped me, that would have helped me then and help me now.
Kristolovich says her life has not been easy. She's open about the fact she had a tumultuous upbringing and battled addiction in her past. She's proof that yoga and mindfulness can assist people in taking control of their lives.
I think there's so many wonderful things they can take away from this, but more than anything, they'll find out that inside of them, they have what they need to regulate and to feel good and to make right choices.
Someday in the near future, Springfield students may be told that instead of going to detention, they need to go take some time for yoga and meditation. It's happened elsewhere, and it appears it could be coming to a school near you. I'm Rachel Otwell.
And I'm Mike McCurdy. You're listening to Sound Ideas on GLT. listening to Sound Ideas. A retired Unit 5 educator recently called for more aggressive efforts to hire minority teachers in Bloomington Normal. Camille Taylor made her remarks during a panel discussion following a screening of a documentary about threats to the African-American middle class. GLT's Charlie Schlenker talks with District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley about that question, which Riley says is a challenge.
It's a very difficult task, and it's one of those things that we've attempted to do over a number of years, and there's a lot of factors that play into that, but here's one of the things that we're doing. We, at one time, and this was pointed out during the, or at least maybe after the viewing of the documentary, we have a minority teacher recruitment committee that meets periodically. That committee has been in the works for quite a number of years. It was there when I was a building principal. It was there when I was an assistant superintendent of HR. That group consisted of Illinois State University, Illinois Wesleyan, representatives from Unit 5, District 87, Heartland Community College, and Lincoln College. And what we attempted to do during that time was to grow our own students and ultimately give them scholarships to those institutions. And in the end, they would come back to our schools and teach in our buildings. We had very limited success with that in the 90s. And then you fast forward to today, that committee has been stagnant for a while. But even prior to that documentary, I've got two board members who've come on recently, two newer board members who have an interest in this area, and they've committed to reviving that. So Dr. Herschel Hanna, my assistant superintendent of human resources, he'll be a part of that. We'll invite those other institutions to reignite that. But we're spreading that out to not just our own students, but to students who are at those respective institutions, and out of that would be a commitment to come into our schools. The reality we face is there are not a lot of candidates to begin with in any of our educational areas. All of our teaching areas are declining in the number of candidates. That's the first thing.
Yeah, there's a widespread teacher shortage.
Exactly. And then you add to that shortage, minority candidates are very few, far in between. And what I found in my experience in trying to recruit minority candidates from different areas, if they're not from this area in general, they tend to want to be either in their own hometowns or in larger urban areas such as Chicago, St. Louis, those types of places. So it's very difficult to recruit those folks to a Bloomington Normal area. And I don't have the answers. If I had them, we'd have more. But it is important to get people in front of our kids that look like our kids.
How many do you have? I mean, what is the difference between the teaching body and the demographics of the community?
It's a pretty big difference where we have, and I'm going to give you estimates because I don't know the numbers off the top of my head. We have probably about a 20% African-American population in our students. We have about 9% Hispanic. And then there's a smaller percentage that's biracial. That's a newer category that's come about in the last probably 5 years or so. So you add all those up, and we're pushing probably 40% all across the board. Our minority teaching population, and even if you throw in all certified staff, so administrators, paraprofessionals, is down in the 10% range. So you see there's a big difference between those two, and some of it has to do with the things that we've already mentioned. But those are challenges that all of us are facing across the country. It's not unique to this area. And quite frankly, we're going to have to rely on people like Camille and others who see this as a need to step up and do recruiting for the community, because this is not just a school district issue. It's a community issue. If you really value that and see that as important, we need ambassadors out there in the community to sell this community, to sell the school districts, to make it a very desirable place for minorities to want to come, work, and live.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're speaking, as we periodically do, with District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley. Why do you think the Grow Your Own program in the 90s did not turn out to be all that productive, and how can that be worked on in the second iteration?
Boy, Charlie, if I had the answers to that question, we'd have it done. I don't know. I can speculate. We haven't done any study that can really nail this down. But a lot of kids would not look at education as a career where they're going to make a lot of money. If you think about a high school kid who desires to have a career, they don't tend to think about teaching as one, unless they've had someone who taps them on the shoulder and encourages them. And that's one of the things that we really attempted to do. But if you think about the 90s when we had this program, even my counselors, the people who were working with the kids about careers, that sort of thing, I did not have a minority counselor. You gave the example of Camille Taylor in Unit 5. I don't know how many candidates or how many kids Camille might have been able to influence to get into education. I suspect she probably had some success compared to us, but when you try to tackle something of this magnitude, if you get a few, that's great, but in large numbers, that's a different challenge. And so I think some of it is just the fact that they don't see those people in front of them. It's not someone that looks like them. Now, we do have folks in the community. We have mentors. We work with the Hunter Blackmen. We work with the NAACP. And, you know, there's a phrase that the Hunter Blackmen use quite a bit: they will be what they see. And if they don't have role models standing in front of them that look like them, sometimes that just doesn't even spark the interest to go in that particular area. So we have a lot of work to do, but it's certainly not laid at the footsteps solely of the school districts. If our community wants to make that a priority, then the community has to help make that a priority and help recruit to make that happen. We cannot do that on our own. Remember, we are a public school district, and it's not as if I have large departments of people that I can send across the country to do recruiting like a big business can. Even though we're one of the larger employers in the community, we just don't have departments like that. We have limited budgets. We have limited means to be able to go and sell ourselves, whether if you go to, we've attempted things like going down to recruit at the historically black colleges in the South, and we've had absolutely zero success doing that. Now, we don't have a lot of experience in marketing and selling. That's not what most of us went to school for. And when you compare us to a company that can do that and have specific departments that have that kind of expertise, you start to understand why it doesn't really work for school districts, because we just don't have those departments to be able to do it.
Looking forward, are you going to need more of African-American teachers or more Hispanic teachers? What are the demographic projections for that 10 to 15 years out? Statewide, Latinos are the largest and fastest growing minority group.
Sure. It's hard for me to project what we're going to have in terms of our population in 10 or 15 years. I don't suspect it's going to have a dramatic shift to what it has today. But regardless, we don't have enough as it stands right now. So those two that you mentioned would be a priority. And it's very difficult. One of the things we had at one point in time was a bilingual principal leading Bent Elementary School, and we've got a great principal there today, but he's not a bilingual principal. He's working really hard on that, but he isn't today. And that made a big difference for those families that were there, and may have even inspired some to think about education as a career, because they had a role model that was standing right there as the leader in that building. But we have had some limited success in getting some Hispanic teachers through our doors, or some Hispanic paraprofessionals. So there are some, but certainly not the numbers that we would like to see. And I can give you a good example of what I did last year. I offered jobs to two bilingual teachers a year and a half in advance, because those positions are very difficult to fill. One of those two happened to be a Hispanic individual, and we were successful in landing one of the two, and it happened to be the Hispanic individual. But that doesn't always work, even when you're offering jobs to kids coming out of college a year and a half in advance.
They haven't even done their student teaching by
then.
They
haven't even done that
you
at the risk
exactly
of...
You don't exactly know how they're going to turn out.
At the risk of that and at the risk of you have the potential to even be overstaffed if you don't have the growth you might expect or there's no turnover in the staff. Those folks have the ability to pick and choose where they want to go. The market's very good for those candidates. But for us, it's limiting because the pool is very thin. And, you know, again, when you think about Hispanics who want to make a difference, and again, I'm generalizing to my own experiences and conversations with folks, they tend to want to go to the places where there's larger concentrations of native Spanish speakers. So they'll target areas like Texas and Arizona and those places who not only have those demographics in greater concentration, but they look at things like the climate and the weather. And here we're in central Illinois, and we have, you know, we're approaching the gray and dreary days. And if you're out there recruiting in those types of weather conditions, that doesn't look attractive to a number of candidates. So we have to sell in other ways, and that's very challenging.
Barry Riley is the superintendent of District 87. Thanks so much for joining us.
You bet, Charlie.
I'm Charlie Schlinker.
And you're listening to GLT and Sound Ideas.
My favorite program on GLT is On the Media. I'm Mike Tooney, a GLT contributing listener. It's easy when thinking of the news to think of content, but On the Media looks closer at the forces that shape how stories are crafted and even what stories are presented. In our media-saturated lives, On the Media helps me be better informed. This is the GLT Fund Drive. Help pay for On the Media and everything GLT does with your contribution now. Click on donate at WGLT.org.
The Fund Drive goal is in sight, and with your help, we can meet the goal before the drive ends. Don't wait a minute longer, though. Time is running short. The drive ends today. Every contribution makes a big difference, including yours. Get it done now at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mike McCurdy. The union representing prison guards is sounding an alarm over dangerous working conditions. That's the topic of the Illinois Politics Roundtable. IPR's Sean Crawford moderates the panel with Charlie Wheeler of the University of Illinois at Springfield, John O'Connor of the Associated Press, and IPR's Brian Mackey, who says the union, AFSCME, is reporting a 51% increase in inmate assaults on correctional workers.
The Department of Corrections doesn't actually dispute that. They also see an increase, a smaller increase in the 30 to 40% range, but they're using a slightly different metric, so it's not quite an apples to apples comparison. They base it on fiscal years, not calendar years, but the bigger picture is that they do acknowledge the increase. They say there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them has to do with inmates who have mental health disorders, and they say that yes, they are trying to treat those people differently. In the past, they might have just locked them up and thrown away the key, so to speak. Although, I mean, they would not put it that way, but that's what the lawyers for those thousands of inmates in a class action have said. And now that they are trying to do treatment under pressure from this lawsuit, and they settled this lawsuit by agreeing to take all these steps. The prison guard saying, well, you can't, just stop punishing inmates with nothing to replace it. And DOC is having a hard time recruiting psychiatrists and psychologists and the people they need to really ramp up this program. But ultimately, I think it is interesting, and John, you can talk about this. It is not necessarily the common response of DOC when the union complains about something to say, yes, we acknowledge that, you know, at least even the numbers, we agree that, you know, there is this increase happening. But there is something else to think about, which is how you define assault, right? The union is highlighting the terrible incidents where people end up going to the hospital, they're off work for a long time. Corrections points out that that does happen, but it's a smaller share. The majority of assaults are actually just inmates. Maybe it could be bumping into you in the line, and that's considered an assault. Or even throwing bodily fluids at a guard. As disgusting as that is, that still counts as an assault, but it's not necessarily something that would, you know, have somebody be hospitalized and be off work for a long time.
So does AFSCME want, what do they want, I guess, out of this? Do they want more people? That seems to usually be what the union has pushed for, that they feel as though there needs to be more guards and more people who work in the prisons. Is that what they're saying here? Is there something else that they want?
This is an interesting twist to this. We go through this every few years. There is a spike here or a spike there, and there's some conversation about what's going on. AFSCME this time says that one of the major drivers here is Governor Bruce Rauner, the Republican governor, has called for a 25% reduction in the prison population, which we know spiked several years ago under Governor Pat Quinn. And too many people are locked up. The prisons are overtaxed. Well, what AFSCME says is what's happening is that inmates are being reclassified. There's pressure on counselors in the prisons who classify the threat level of prisoners, and that when we talk about shortening sentences or giving more good time, you would expect to see the effects of that at the minimum security level, the lower level security prisons where there are nonviolent offenders being held. Instead, AFSCME says there's an 18% decrease in the populations at maximum security prisons, and they wonder whether corrections is purposely downgrading the threat level of these maximum security prisoners and putting them in medium security prisons, which are less costly to operate and have fewer staff members, therefore driving the number of assaults. Correction says, no, that's not the case. We do reclassify prisoners on an annual basis, and classify prisoners based on their progress. So, yes, if there is a person serving 20 years for murder, and he's within 4 or 5 years of release to the community, we do need to, and he's shown progress and behaved himself, we do need to prepare him for reentry into the community. So there will be cases where someone serving a sentence for murder is at a lower level security prison, but not if he doesn't deserve to be there.
Charlie, does it make sense to you as far as what AFSCME is saying on this?
Yeah, and I think the bottom line is we have to invest more in our correctional system. And it's been something that's been known for years. Pat Quinn had an early release program that came under a lot of criticism because some prisoners were being let out within a day or so of the time they arrived because of time that they had served at the county jail level. And so there was a shutdown on the early release program and the prisons spiked. But our prison population, if you look historically since, the 80s and the war on drugs, it's increased dramatically. For a while, we were building a new prison a year. We went from something like 4,000 inmates in the late 70s and a prison budget of maybe $200 million a year to now we have like 42,000 in the institutions, and the budget is in excess of $1 billion. A lot of it had to do with the punitive way we came down on drugs. And it requires money, not having enough psychiatrists to deal with people who have mental issues. A significant number of the people who are locked up do have mental issues. They're mentally ill, they need treatment, and we're not investing the money to provide that. And for a lot of years, the notion was, well, you just lock them up and throw away the key. We don't have to do anything with them. We just forget about them. That was sort of the public. And lawmakers fell over themselves trying to imposed tougher penalties, longer prison terms to show that they were tough on crime. But the fact is, most of the people who are in the prison will be out at some point. And the idea of having a correctional system is that we try to correct their behavior, give them the tools that they need, give them counseling if they have substance abuse problems, give them education if they don't have a background, if they've only gone through 4 or 5 years of grade school, try and provide them with some skills, vocational skills, so if there's something for them to do and they can reintegrate into the community when they are released. But all of that stuff takes money, and as we well know, the state doesn't have a whole lot of money to go around.
According to Corrections Director John Baldwin, is that 70% of the assaults, he says, are perpetrated by inmates with mental illness. And that's the kind of thing that they're emphasizing, is that many times these are mentally ill prisoners who are acting out.
Charlie Wheeler, IPR's Brian Mackey, and John O'Connor of the Associated Press are the Illinois Politics Roundtable, moderated by Sean Crawford. It's Sound Ideas on GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media. The colors red and white will be seen in abundance this week as town and gown alike celebrate a cherished autumn tradition. Laura Kennedy has more in this edition of the GLT Datebook.
Illinois State University Homecoming Week festivities kick off this coming week, involving activities for the whole community. Doris Groves is the executive director of alumni engagement, and she says that there's always a theme to homecoming each year, and this one looks to the future. It's building a legacy.
We're excited that we can think about where we've been and our past, where we are presently, and where we're moving to in the future.
So, Doris, why is homecoming important?
I think it's important because it's that one time of year when everyone who is engaged with the university can really show their Redbird pride. So it really encompasses all of our constituents, so whether that is students, alumni, of course, but also our faculty, staff, and our community partners, too. So it's kind of that opportunity to pull everybody together so that we can celebrate Illinois State University.
One of the coolest things that happens at homecoming time that really reinforces that connection between the community and the university is the lighting ceremony that
yes.
they do. Tell me more about that.
That's
right. On the 16th.
That'll be on the 16th. So that's one of the events that kicks off our homecoming week on Monday, October 16th. It will begin at 6:30, and then there'll be a program at 7 o'clock where really it's a town and gown relationship. So all the trees and the lights in the trees that decorate Uptown Normal from now throughout the holiday season and the wintertime are lit for the first time at homecoming.
Also during homecoming week, you have something called Hoop Fest on
right.
the 20th at 7 p.m. That'll be over at Redbird Arena. What's Hoop Fest?
Right. That's on Friday evening. Again, all of our community members are invited to join us. At 6:45, we'll be doing our royalty crowning, so our student homecoming king and queen. And then at 7 o'clock, everybody in the community really gets that first look at men's and women's Redbird basketball teams. So they do some fun events as a team, and you can really get a chance to see what we're going to expect for our men and women's basketball this year.
An enormously popular event is the Town and Gown 5K and 1 mile fun run walk, which is Saturday the 21st, and that begins at 8 a.m., and that really reinforces the ties between the university and the community.
Absolutely. The Town and Gown 5K has been going on for many years, and we have close to 500 participants
wow.
in that race. It follows the parade route, so it's an opportunity for those that are our runners in the community and our walkers to really do a timed race, to get their time. It's chipped, the whole thing, and very exciting. It kicks off from the on University Street right in front of the Student Fitness Center.
Well, of course, after the race, it's something that a lot of people of all ages love, especially the kids, because we're talking about candy gets handed out.
Exactly.
The parade
yes.
is at 10 a.m.
Yes, we love the parade. It starts at the Bone Student Center, but then really goes all the way through Uptown Normal and back. Just a wonderful chance to see all the students in action, but we have a lot of community entries as well. So community floats and community organizations that march in the parade, too.
Well, my favorite in the parade is always the big red marching machine,
of course.
Absolutely.
And they are decked to the tees, and it really is. It's an awesome start.
During football season, of course, very, very popular is tailgating that Saturday. So tell me about the tailgating.
So the tailgating lots will actually open up at 7 o'clock, and there are still a few tailgate spaces available. So if people are interested in still reserving a spot, do that immediately. The tailgating then actually opens at 7, but the main tailgating is probably from about 11 o'clock until 2 o'clock, so following the parade. In the tent zone, if you don't have a tailgate spot, everybody is welcome to come to the tent zone, which is on the north side of Hancock. And we'll have an alumni tent that everyone is welcome at. Plus, each of our academic colleges host a tent as well. So they're anxious to get the alumni back on campus and get a chance to visit with them. So that's a fun time before the start of the game.
And the game starts at 2 o'clock, of course, in Hancock Stadium. We're taking on South Dakota.
Right.
And we've only lost one game so far this year. So
yes.
It's going to be a really good matchup.
It is going to be a great matchup. South Dakota has a great team. The Coyotes are excellent, but I think we're better. It's setting up to be a fantastic showdown.
That's Doris Groves, Executive Director of Alumni Engagement at Illinois State University. ISU's homecoming is next week. You can find more information at homecomingillinoisstate.edu. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The Uptown tree lighting ceremony gets underway tonight at 6:30 at Gateway Plaza between the Children's Discovery Museum and Uptown Station. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Find the stories and interviews you heard today at our website, WGLT.org. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post your comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM. This is WGLT Normal. We'll be right back.